All right, just so we continue with the telecom portion of the conference, and with us today, Tony Staffieri, CFO of Rogers. Thank you, Tony, for coming. I'll start as I did with the TELUS, talking maybe a broad question about what you're seeing in the wireless business, the trends, the drivers. Has anything changed since last year? There seemed to be some slowness in net additions in the sector. Is this temporary, and or you know, just a general view on what you're seeing right now?
Sure. First off, good morning, everyone, and thank you for having us. In terms of the wireless market and what we have been seeing and what we're seeing, you know, in the early parts of this year, I would say we saw good growth in the sector, as you know, in 2018, and sort of ended the year with overall subscriber growth of 5.7%, and I think that was fairly healthy growth.
Yes.
If we look to the reasons, you know, why we're seeing that in Canada, I think we've been consistent, and we continue to believe that the main drivers really revolve around three items. One is just our inherent lower penetration rates compared to other developed countries, and particularly the U.S. You know, in Canada, we sit at 87%. Growing nicely, but the U.S. sits at about 120%. And there aren't significant structural reasons why those should be different. And so we see continued headroom for penetration growth in Canada. The second item is clearly immigration. Continues to be healthy in the country at about 2%. In some of the urban centers, it's slightly higher than that. And so that clearly is providing some of the subscriber growth that we've seen. And then finally, second devices, particularly in corporate world, more and more folks looking to have a personal device in addition to business. We see a lot more of that in the U.S., or have seen a lot more of that in the U.S., and that's sort of coming to Canada as well, particularly in the age of cybersecurity issues and phones being more and more secure, and therefore you're much more limited in what you can do. And so those have been sort of the three factors that have driven the subscriber growth. You know, as we look to Q1, we are seeing a bit of a slower market. We still expect it to be growth in the market overall for the first quarter, but probably more muted than what we saw in Q4. Now, mind you, Q1 is cyclically a much lower volume quarter than the rest of the year, so I don't know, there's a lot to read into it. There's been much less promotional activity this year. So certainly if you're trying to compare it to last year was a bit of an anomaly. You may recall in the fourth quarter, there was a lot of hype around some of the promotions, and in particular the 10 gig plan. And that spilled into Q1, especially for us, as we caught up on volumes in the first quarter. And so last year, you know, I'd say Q4 and Q1 was a bit of an anomaly in terms of the spillover that happened. And so if you want to compare Q1 to last year, I think it's important that you look at Q4 and Q1 together to get a better sense as to what's happening. So all that to say, still good growth in the industry. As we look to the rest of the year, continue to forecast healthy growth, and wouldn't read too much into the first quarter more mild type of activity that we're seeing. I think it's important, you know, subscribers only one piece of it. I think the second piece of it is really what's happening with revenue growth. And, you know, revenue last year for the industry on service revenue grew 5%, and I think that's pretty healthy, mostly for the industry driven by subscriber growth, obviously. For us, it was a combination of subscriber and ARPU growth, and we continue to see opportunity to grow ARPU into this year. You might see a bit of a slowdown on ARPU growth for us in the first quarter, but nonetheless, it's going to be, in our view, on the positive side of the ledger. And so we see good, healthy growth there. So we're focused on not just subscribers, but ARPU as well. And so it's revenue share that we're after.
There's like a big gap between your ARPU growth or APU growth with TELUS and NBC. What would you say the main reason for that, and how sustainable can that continue?
Yeah, at the core, I can't speak to, obviously, what our competitors are thinking or seeing. I can tell you our focus on ARPU growth has been largely centered around data growth. That's really the driver of it. And so our strategy has been to make sure the customer is comfortable with their data usage, give them all the tools so they no longer have bill shock and have bill certainty, and have the customer feel comfortable move up in data bands that continues to give them that usage certainty that they're looking for. And doing that not just in the acquisition, but in managing the base as well. So it's a delicate balance that we're after, but it's really, the core focus for us is really how do you continue to get the customer to use more data? That's really at the core of it. And then the monetization of that will come afterwards. And so, as I said, for us, we continue to see opportunity to grow ARPU, blended ARPU on that basis, as well as postpaid ARPU.
It seems overage was a main culprit for their decline in ARPU growth. What would you say overage, the risk in your overage bill as a percentage of the total bill of the customer? Has that declined to a level where it would not pose a risk to ARPU going forward?
I think it's fair to say for the industry overall, overage revenues have come down. We all followed the strategy of trying to convert overage revenue, which is not a great customer experience because it's something that's incremental on your bill, to something that is already included in your monthly service fee. So I would say as an industry, we've done a good job of trying to move the customer to bigger data buckets. I think at the same time, what happened over the last 18 months is really, if you look at price per gig, we probably saw the biggest price deflation on data than we've ever seen in terms of the industry providing bonus data. And so when we look at, and what we look at very closely is the actual data usage per user, and how does that compare to their monthly data cap? And so what we see is a little bit of a widening, and so over time as the usage goes up, that sort of goes back in balance. And so it's really that balance that's key to continuing to drive ARPU growth.
Okay. How is Freedom affecting your business, if at all? When you look at their strategy, their pricing strategy, and the tit-for-tat type maneuver that we're seeing in the market in Q4 and Q3, have you seen any loss of share to them?
I would say it's minimal. It comes back to the discussion we were just having about, the market's been growing at a healthy pace,
and I think it's been able to
absorb some of the what I would describe as short-term success that Freedom is having. Not a surprise to anyone here, their value proposition continues to be centered around discount pricing and at the same time heavy subsidy, that it's more than 2x the industry norm. And so we continue to view that as short term. It's just they aren't sustainable economics. And so at the right price points with our right brands being Chatter and Fido, they largely compete with Freedom, and we continue to look for ways to go head-to-head with them on the value proposition. But we look to other parts as well that are much more long-term in nature. We continue to focus on our network as a competitive advantage, not only in terms of coverage, but capacity within the urban centers. And our investments in the network continue to provide us with that competitive advantage. We look to points of distribution. Today we sit at over 2,500 points of distribution. That's probably 4x what someone like Freedom would have. And so although digital adoption continues to increase, for a long while we see points of distribution as continuing to be important, not only for acquisitions, but for upgrades as well. And we see customers continuing to opt to go into a store for an upgrade as opposed to have it delivered to their home. So those are some of the things. And then the final one is customer service, and you see that through churn. And that's been a focus for us, and we continue to see it as an improving competitive advantage over Freedom. So we're much more focused on the long-term fundamentals of our value proposition than short-term.
Okay. 600 auction going on right now. I know you can't talk about the actual process or what's going on, but how important is securing 600 megahertz to your organization? And if I look forward to the next auction, it seems like it's more important to secure the spectrum for 5G. How much you think that auction could be in multiples of what we could see in 600.
Yeah. Well, Mayor, as you said, there's nothing, I'm prevented from saying anything on 600. The auction, for those of you not familiar with it, started on March 12th. And so we're into now, I guess, the second week of the auction, and there's nothing I can comment on it. Other than to say 600 is a component of the 5G spectrum structure, but the more important ones are the upcoming ones, 3500 in particular, which is slated for 2020 perhaps in terms of an auction. The upper band spectrums are going to be the more important ones. We believe the government should make more blocks available on the 3500, similar to what you saw in the US. The amounts that originally slated just aren't enough for the industry in Canada. And I think there's a lot of user upside if more blocks become available. And so we'll see what happens there. We already have some 3500, and that is currently fully deployed, and it meets all the, we've met all the conditions of license on that. And that will be refarmed for 5G in due course. But that's where we're at.
Okay. CRTC, I asked the question to Doug before you. What's your take on what the CRTC is trying to do with their hearing next year? Their language change about MVNO. What's the position that Rogers is likely to take in that process?
Well, our position will be clear. We think they had it right when they made the decision on Sugar Mobile not too long ago. Mandated MVNOs without investment in facilities, we think is harmful. You know, as we look around the world where there have been mandated MVNOs, it's difficult to point out any success story long-term for any of the constituents on it.
Short-term, you can have some a relief for the consumer, but long-term investments will suffer likely.
I think that's what we've seen around the world. And so I think a couple of points to highlight. You know, the decision on mandated MVNO is going to be a long one. This is the beginning of a process. And, you know, by the government's own admission, this is going to go into 2020. So it's going to be a long due process, well beyond the election that'll happen this fall. Two, mandated MVNO decision is really the first part. The second one, which is just important, just as important, if not more important, is at what rate. And so if you think about, you know, we've had a version of mandated MVNO, for example, on the cable side of the business, where we provide wholesale internet capacity. And those are a fully regulated, fully costed rates. And they really haven't had an impact on the cable internet business. So that's why I say it's an important part of it. And then the other piece we sort of think about is, you know, if you think about Canada, we have the industry as a whole has one of the best networks in the world. And we participate in that with our own network, with national coverage. And that happens because of a regulatory framework that continues to encourage facilities-based investment. We've recently seen the government with its accelerated depreciation program, which we think is terrific to continue to encourage investment in our networks, both in wireless and in cable. And then you look at what are the impacts likely going to be in other industries and in other parts of the world where we've seen mandated MVNO. It isn't the large, well-executing company that is going to be most impacted. It's going to be the smaller players. And so those are the ones that are going to be most impacted by deep discounting MVNO, if that were to ever happen. And so the complexity for the government is they've been heavily subsidizing the likes of Freedom and Videotron up until now.
With Spectrum.
That's right, through the Spectrum, et cetera. And so to then have mandated MVNO that is probably going to have the biggest impact on those players is something to think about. So, you know, I end where I started. It'll be a process. You know, our view on it for the sake of not just us, but the country, is that it's not a good thing. And you'll see that come through in our participation.
Okay. CapEx, you guys seem to have had a more aggressive take on how much CapEx you'd like to invest in the upcoming years. Can you tell us where this incremental dollar of spending is going? And as we look, you started putting promotional ads on TV. I saw yesterday a promotional ad for 5G. telling people that it's coming. When is it coming, and when do you expect to start seeing revenue from 5G?
Sure. So a couple of things there you touched on, Mayor. One is, you know, why now in terms of increasing CapEx? We think the environment is right. You know, we've got technology in front of us like 5G and ever-increasing consumer demand on the home side, on the home front. Leading networks has been a competitive advantage for us, and it needs to continue to be a competitive advantage for us long term. When we think about CapEx cycles, although we provide guidance for the year, we think about CapEx cycles in a much longer term horizon. So we kind of say, let's see where we're at. We've got a company with terrific fundamentals. We're growing top line, growing margins, and importantly, we're growing cash flow, even after the increased CapEx. We've got an environment where the government is encouraging investment through accelerated depreciation that I mentioned before. We've got historically low long-term interest rates on for incremental capital. So you combine our balance sheet with leverage continuing to come down with the opportunity to make investments in some of these new technologies. And we think that sort of the time is right to increase that investment. And as I said, we are being thoughtful in making that investment while still growing after-tax free cash flow.
Right. And 5G, when do you think it's going to be operational in Canada?
It'll take time. I think, you know, we've already been doing trials. You've heard about our trials on the UBC campus out west. And we have what I would call narrow trials throughout the rest of Canada and in high volume areas like the Rogers Centre in Toronto. I would say the technology is coming along. I wouldn't be surprised later this year if you saw on the consumer side ads for 5G handsets. But I think the ability to actually use 5G will be much limited and much more isolated. So I think the consumer side of it, more so from a marketing standpoint, will kind of grow over the next little while. In terms of usage, it'll start with consumer over the next few years. But the real business case for 5G continues to center around enterprise. And I would say those business models are still in their infancy. And we see that happening in sort of the 3 to 5 year horizon, maybe 2 to 5 year horizon. But it's going to be a while. And so our investments in 5G are sort of going to be commensurate with our ability to monetize it as those use cases come on board.
Okay. Any questions on wireless before I turn to cable? Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, well, let me ask you. So what did Telus say? You said yes. But no, okay. No, I'm just kidding. I'll.
The long process is saying that it will hamper the investment, but we know that 40% margin is in
yeah.
that rate. So
yeah.
Why would it hamper the investment?
Yeah. I think long term, when you see it, any time you have someone that can price on an incremental basis, is never going to be a healthy long-term player for the industry or for the economy. I always look to, and I made reference to it, if you were to look at the cable side of it, and we have mandated somewhat MVNO type of structure in that industry, I would say the resellers generally have a long time in terms of being a long-term viable competitor. In the marketplace. And so especially in the early days, what you saw is many coming in and then leaving just because the economics are too difficult. So keep in mind that when you think about MVNO, it's not just the cost of transport of data or voice, frankly, but it's the all-in cost of customer service, the all-in cost of marketing. And so efficiency and size matters. And so to have a reseller trying to compete, it generally ends up being a short-term game. And so just don't see it as viable long-term.
Can it help you serve certain customers? Can it help you, let's say, with seniors that don't want to use more than 2GB, newcomers, incoming roaming, things like that, yes? Like kids, young people that not necessarily need more than 4 to 5 hours of screen time a day. So these are the trends that consumers, you know, are hitting at the moment. What will drive the data usage for these segments up? And why MVNOs cannot serve it, or you know, Chatter or other entities that have a different business model?
Yeah, so I think your question, if I could rephrase it, is, you know, are there niche plays for MVNOs? And the answer is sure, there always is, but they generally do it in the sense of they hope that that trend grows. And if the niche play becomes mainstream, then we will provide that value offering. And so that's why I say for MVNOs, it always ends up being a short-term game, and it's difficult for it to be a long-term strategy.
Okay. Turning to cable, you've had Ignite and Ignite TV in the market for a bit now. Can you tell us about your experience, customer satisfaction metrics? Have they changed since the launch? And churn, maybe more importantly, how would you see churn?
Yeah, good question. I on the cable side, we're still quite excited about the Ignite TV. And for those of you not familiar, it's the Comcast IP version of Xfinity. We went through a pretty rigorous testing period and had a large number of employees at scale testing the product before we launched it in the back half of last year. And I would say volumes are ramping up and we're pleased with the metrics that we're seeing. You know, if I were to look at the three big ones, churn in the first 60 days, way down compared to the legacy product. If you were to look at likelihood to recommend as a form of NPS, way up compared to the previous product. And most importantly, we look at ARPA and how does it compare to the previous product, and it's up relative to the previous product. So it still is in the scheme of the whole program, early days. But we have quite a bit of volume, and we like what we're seeing in terms of the product. And keep in mind, it's an adjunct to internet. It fundamentally is bundled with internet. And so when we look at the economics of that combination, it's been working really well. The product, as most of you know, it has YouTube, Netflix integrated. Amazon Prime is going to be embedded in there as well in the next month or two. And so the product itself continues to have a very good roadmap. And we continue to follow the Comcast roadmap more broadly in terms of the connected home. And so later this year you'll see xFi coming on board, our version of it. And you'll see xHome coming out as well. So a very good roadmap for us. And so we're very pleased with what we're seeing so far.
One of the issues that Shaw had when they launched X1 is that the cost of the product itself with the support and the set-top box was too high to target the mass market. It was only the high-priced product points that were able to make profitable selling X1. How is it for your business right now? Are you able to bring it down to most of your customers, or it's only the high-paying customers that can get it?
It's important to note that our product is a different version of the Shaw version. They launched the legacy hybrid version, which still needed set-top boxes and hardwire connection in the home. We went with the IP version, and so it's a wireless product throughout the home. And the cost per CPE is much, much less. And so much so if you were to look, compare it to our legacy product, the average home costs us about $1,200 with just over an average of two TVs when you include set-top boxes. Cost per home with our new model is under $400 and declining. So it's a completely different roadmap in terms of price structure. When we launched the product, we launched it at the premium segment. So as I said, it's combined with internet. We launched it at the premium, so you could only get it with 500 megs or 1 gig, and very high package, because we wanted to constrain demand in the early days as we made sure that the operational and customer experience was well. We then expanded that to lower tiers of internet, and so we've done that, as well as lower packaging tiers. So it's now available sort of across the whole value proposition band, and it's hunting in all parts of that spectrum.
So what's the limiting factor in increasing penetration inside your homes past with this technology? Is it CapEx, the 400? That's the limiting factor, how much you want to spend per year, or is it operational?
No, it's a combination of consumer demand and pacing consumer demand with the techs we have available. Although the product will lend itself to self-install in the future, in these early days, we want it to be a white glove experience. And so we are having techs come out and install the product and make sure the consumer's familiar with the product. And so I would say it's a combination of all those that are limiting the amount we can do, but we've quickly ramped up in terms of training, resources, et cetera. And that'll, you know, continue to ramp up. And so if you're to look at, you know, how many we do per day relative to 6 months ago, we're probably at 10 times more per day in capacity than we were 6 months ago. And so we'll continue to ramp that up. I would say, I wouldn't say capital is a constraint. We think about it as a very good business model. And so if there's more we can do, then we will do, because the economics are so good.
Okay. On Bell and their FTTH deployment in the 416 area, how has it been so far, the experience competing against them? In terms of price, how aggressive are they in your territory? We've heard stories of guys going from door to door, giving up $100 Visa cards, right, et cetera.
I think a couple of things. I would say on the whole, competing with FTTH, we'll let the facts speak for themselves. I mean, we've been competing against the Bell Fibe brand and product for 10 years now. And the FTTH in the 416 was supposedly going to go mass marketing a year ago. And the facts are, when you look at our internet penetration, for almost 3.5 years, every quarter we've consistently increased internet penetration by 1 point. If you're to look at our quarterly reportings on internet net subscriber additions, we report on balance about the same as our competitor, even though they have 3 times the footprint. So our ubiquitous 1 gig offering to all 4.3 million homes we passed has been a clear competitive advantage for us that is working. And we lead on the product itself rather than on price. There have been, I would say, promotionally intense periods, particularly in the back half of 2018, where we both continue to compete aggressively. I would say that sort of seems to have become much more muted in the first quarter. And so there's much more of a slowdown in that type of competitive intensity. But it'll sort of fluctuate up and down, we expect, throughout the year.
Okay. You still own a large amount of shares of Cogeco. A few years back, you had hinted to the potential of monetizing, or not seeing a clear opportunity to do anything with these shares. What's your take on them right now? Has it changed? Is there any reason to hold them or not to hold them?
Well, the way we think about it is we're in the connectivity business, and we're focused on the connectivity business. Cogeco is a connectivity business, and so we think about our holdings as more investment in connectivity, and we keep weighing sort of short-term decisions and short-term values against a longer-term strategic value for Cogeco. So we have a much longer-term view of where the potential upside is in those shares. There isn't anything imminent that we are looking at doing with those shares, but it's a longer term view that we have. That's probably all I can say.
It seems like you regained some patience with holding those shares than what you had a few years back.
I think we see long-term value,
in
the connectivity business, and I'll probably leave it at that.
Okay. New year, new dividend, higher dividend. It's been a while. You have not increased your dividend, but you did say that you're not attached to growing the dividend every year. What do you need to see from the operations in terms of free cash flow growth or EBITDA growth to be able to give you enough conviction to keep growing that dividend?
I think we put it in the category of, when is the right time to return cash to shareholders? And we've been consistent on the point that we're focused on growing the fundamentals, grow the top line, expand margins, and grow cash flow. Make sure we invest in the core of our business for the long term. And then with the cash left over, what's the best way to return it to shareholders? And so what you saw with our dividend increase, it was commensurate with cash flow growth we have been experiencing and the cash flow growth that we've put forward in our guidance for 2019. So as we move forward, we'll continue to look at excess cash in that context. It could be in the form of a dividend or it could be in the form of a share buyback. You know, fundamentally, we look at it, in terms of the factors you would expect, that if we have excess cash, then we look to things like our yield and our payout ratio. And then on the buyback side, we look at where our share price is at vis-a-vis our internal models of valuation. And one might lead to a better answer than the other for shareholders overall. So I would say we are not committed to any one particular strategy, and we're not committed to making a long-term commitment on dividend increases. But as we continue to earn our cash flow, then we'll make the right decisions at that time.
Okay. Any questions from the audience? Thank you, Tony.
Thank you very much.
It's always a pleasure to have you here.